The entire boys basketball team at Richmond High School in California has been benched. Even though the highly ranked Oilers have a perfect season on the court, some of the players were in big trouble academically. So Coach Ken Carter canceled practice and sent the team to the library to study, and they had to forfeit two games. Coach Ken Carter is at the school gym this morning. Coach Carter, good morning.
Hi, Katie. How are you, ma'am?
I'm fine, thank you. I understand that under California rules, Coach Carter, that your players were eligible to play since they all had a GPA of a C-minus grade point average. So why did you bench the whole team?
Yes, the district requires that our student athletes have a 2.0. All our athletes have a 2.0. But as a team, we set higher goals for ourselves. And so in setting those higher goals, that's what I had to do to get our point across for our student athletes.
In fact, before the season started, I understand you made all the players sign a contract. What were some of the stipulations of that contract?
Well, that they would attend all classes, that they would be on time, their conduct in class would be excellent, no tardiness, and they would participate in class.
They would sit in the front row of the class was another stipulation of the contract, that sophomores have a 2.3 GPA, juniors a 2.5, and seniors a 3.0, correct?
No, that's not correct. That's something that we're going to put in place in the future, but the contract stated that all our kids would have a 2.3 and working towards a higher GPA at all times.
I always love the backstory of sports per se. Just to really give a basic picture or a summary of Coach Carter.
Okay, yeah. Coach Carter is a movie released in 2005, and it's about the basketball coach Ken Carter, who did something unprecedented ever in the history of sports. For a team to have, you know, a long run of wins, and for a coach to go something extreme by stopping them from playing a game is something unprecedented. So he was someone that became a topic of national interest. Basically, what happened was he was an all-star as a young kid. You know, he had a scoring and assist records in 1972 and 1972. And then he came back to his hometown and he finds out that his team that he used to play for when he was a kid was struggling. You know, they had so many issues on and off the courts. And his old, you know, old-time friend and old-time buddy asked him to come in to do a short-term job for like 5 or 4 months. Eventually, he agrees to take the job. And what happens in the movie Coach Carter is basically how he handled the job and how he was able to pass his message across.
We're looking at a team that they are coming from a season where they just won 4 games and lost.
Yeah.
I think a game, 22. Their season was 22. They lost 22 games.
4-22. Yeah.
Yeah, 4-22. Now, Coach Carter is brought in to try to do what some people may term the impossible. First of all, you're talking about high school kids in their teens, or some of them are just at the Rubicon where they are trying to get out of their teens. They are actually people who are, for lack of a better way to put it, they are unruly children and they lack a lot of discipline. And what we see in this movie as it stands is that Coach Carter is given this job to start with. And as he's given this job, I'm trying to go to the scene where Coach Carter is actually handed the job. So his friend calls him in and calls the kids and says, this is your new coach. He wants to, first of all, get these kids on his side. But like most of these movies where you see a new teacher comes into the hood and tries to teach unruly kids and these people are very disorganized, we observe here where they are not even looking at him. They are not talking to him, say, who are you? Very insolent. I don't know. You know, when I was watching it, I told myself if I was the one, I probably would just walk out on this job at this point because, man, I'm not trying to do this thing. I'm not trying. But he, first of all, had the big mission of trying to instill discipline into these children. To me, I don't know if that was part of the job, because your job basically is to come and coach people. Now, you have to, first of all, fight your way into trying to discipline these kids. Coach Carter, first of all, he's somebody from Richmond already. So he knows the terrain, he knows the issues. The movie shows where he's actually being insulted with derogatory words on his first day. But I think that in trying to instill discipline, he has to be some kind of macho man in himself, because we see where he's actually on the verge of being physically attacked by a student, and he's able to, you know, disarm the students in 2 seconds. So the guy has a little bit of street in him. And what do you think? Because I think if you are just one, how will I put it, chewing gum chewing kind of guy who just doesn't want to, you know, Ronaldo in the days of Manchester United, football is not a contact sport. It's why are people touching me up and down? And then Sir Alex has to remind him, say, look, my friend, you don't understand what you're doing here. You know, so I'm thinking that, look, the street in him, how did he bring that to the table?
You know, he was someone that grew up in Richmond. He knew all what was going on. And partly that's actually one of the reasons why he even took the job. Because the night before he was offered the job, according to the way the film went, you know, some of these things are not necessarily exact. Absolutely. But according to the way the film went, the night before he took the job, he came to watch a game. And the game was against the school that had his own kid, St. Francis. You know, and he was watching, you know, the boys play. And a huge part of the reason why they were struggling was because of discipline, you know. And, you know, after the game, he goes back into the locker room to see his friend. And his friend is like, man, he's tired. He's getting old. He can't keep running after these kids. He can't get them to sit down. He can't get them to listen. And he personally wasn't in the mood for that. But then, you know, he was spoken to, and because he's from the hood, he had a passion to do things the right way. He had a vision of getting things done a certain way, and that's why he took the job. So I think from the get-go, he already had a feeling that, okay, he was going to have to, you know, knock some heads around to get sense into these boys. Because these boys are basically at that final step where either they become somebody or they're in the streets for life. You know, they're teenagers. That testosterone is running high, adrenaline. Some of them are going to be fathers already, if they're not fathers already. You know, they're all having sex. You know, they're doing drugs. They're hanging out. They can drive. You know, at that time, it's legal to drive by that age, 17. You know, some of them were seniors. So these people were about to become men. So it wasn't just about winning games. You know, you could be winning games, but we're winning the wrong way. He wanted them to win the right way. And so he started off with discipline. You know, the first thing he offered them after he dealt with the situation where he was attacked was he offered them contracts. And those contracts were a way of enforcing discipline, because you can't say you didn't. He gave you something to read and sign. Once you sign it, you have rules you have to abide by. If you don't abide by those rules, you're off the team. And so that was the first thing he tackled. He didn't tackle physical fitness, he didn't tackle anything else. He tackled discipline first, which is the most important thing for anybody in any discipline.
One of the things I find interesting is this whole thing about signing contracts. I think that was the new thing in this whole game, to have these children sign contracts. Now, you have children signing contracts, and I think the normal thing was to have them have a 2.0, but then you have Coach Carter, and this was like, as he's taking the job, he's telling the head of school to print out a couple of papers for them to, you know. Now, these papers are the contracts. And I don't know if she read them. I mean, as we see how the movie progresses. But he's asking these children to maintain a 2.3 grade points average. They must attend all their classes. And then the funny part of this whole contract for me was that they should sit in the front row.
In front.
Of their class. And, okay, now, maybe the woman read the contract and she may have read it and said, look, this guy is a joker, but maybe I will just sign, because let me see how he's going to do it. But you see, the way I see, because, you know, like we always do when we do these shows, we are trying to ask the first question, why in blazes was a whole movie made about some random guy, because there are coaches all across, there are high school coaches all across America. What was the big deal? So this is basically one of the things that get me interested. Now, we look at this contract, and this contract is talking about having these children do academics. And, you know, as a weapon, I feel that was one of his major weapons to be able to instill discipline into these children. But you see, having started the job and you're getting this pushback already from this, so you're having somebody like Timo Cruz, one of the young boys there, who wants to fight already on the first day, and Coach Carter is able to, you know, handle him. Literally, the word I want to use there is manhandle him, and he's having the boys screaming and saying, our teachers are not supposed to touch students. And he said, look, I'm not your teacher. I'm the new basketball coach. I'm the new basketball coach. So you better recognize that it's a new day, you know, and so that you better wake up. And I find that quite significant because, you see, you want to make a change. The problems, you cannot just say, I want to jump into the job. And then he's asking them, you know, he watched the game. Look, okay, this film starts, it opens, he sees them watching the game. And one of the things he sees there is that, look, you people have a problem. And you start giving them very rigorous exercises to do. Now, in also gleaning into the toughness as depicted in this film and the discipline, you know, his son who used to play for St. Francis comes to play for his for Richmond too. And then on his first day, his son is late for basketball practice. And you know this thing of having your own person and everybody's weakness, and people will be looking at you and say, okay, he's his own son. Is he going to be partial to his son? A practice that was supposed to start at 3 o'clock, his son came by 2:55. His dad, who is the coach, he says, he didn't, before he called him his son, he said, hey, this is our new teammate. This is our new teammate, he said, and he's late. You owe us 20 suicides. He tries to explain, maybe he wants to use a daddy, this is my dad connection kind of thing. He said, look, dude, you owe us 20 suicides. And that automatically, you see, I feel that blended him into the team. Everybody can see that this guy, because if they started looking at him as coach's son, he just, you know, disengaged himself from the whole thing. And I feel that one of the reasons he was, because his son wanted to come to play for Richmond. He didn't want his son to play for Richmond. And I believe that the reason he didn't want his son to play for Richmond was because he didn't want his son, so that he will now not seem to be partial. You know, he's his son. Of course, he's a different, he's his son. So it's different. But I mean, gave him a different contract of 3.7 average, which was very high. What did
The funny thing about that was he wanted, because he was from Richmond and he knew the statistics of people that go to Richmond and how they fare later in life. He was a successful person, you know. He had come back to Richmond. He had opened up a sports shop. So he was doing okay. So he prioritized education, because if you read his bio, it's also said that his family too also prioritized education, even though he excelled at sports, you know. So he wanted the same for his son. And his son was in St. Francis, which was a good school. It had a good basketball team, but was a better school. Around the same neighborhood, but a very good school in academics. So he wanted the same thing for his son. And his son kept telling him that, Dad, I just want to play for you. And he was like, no. So I think the son got a hand of the contracts and came back and told his father that, look, you asked for people to maintain a 2.3. I'm going to give you a 3.5. The son gave him a better contract that gave him more control over his son's activities. So when he now told the son that, okay, part of being a man is being able to make your own decisions and dealing with the consequences. So you know what? Since you're now a man and you come with me with these terms, I'm going to make it a 3.7. Maintain a 3.7, follow all the rules, then you can play for the team. And the son signed. And that was it.
Yeah, that shows that he was very committed, actually. And but you see,
the son was a chip off the old block.
Yeah, he was I think he was a chip off the old block. And you see, sometimes when you watch a movie that depicts a true story, there are certain things you want to go and find out as a fact. This is a fact. His son actually played all these things. Actually, did happen. And you know, it's kind of tough. Your boy wants to be, and he wants to play for his dad, which I find kind of beautiful. Means that he really, really raised his son in a way that, you know, he earned his son's respect. And which is like, you know, hard in our today's world nowadays, where everybody, especially in a country like America, where people just want to do their own thing and everything, which I saw it as something that was a beautiful thing, that he wants to play for his dad. And his dad actually showed that, apart from being a disciplinarian on the court. He was also somebody who was doing it already at home, like putting his son in a position whereby he could do. Okay, let's look at how Coach Carter gets this job, and his primary assignment is to win games, and he is given a huge task because they are coming from a season where they only won four games with 22.
That's terrible.
422, 22 losses. That is not even a team. That is like in the Premiership, you should be in like fourth or fifth division.
That's relegation.
Relegation full time. Yeah, that is relegation stats, really. And maybe in basketball, you will never forget about the playoffs. Let's not even talk about that. So the thing is now, how is Coach Carter supposed to do this? And he comes in. One of the things we look at, you see, because you see, like for those of us who watch sports, we find that, okay, if a team is not doing well, maybe they fire the coach, get a new coach that comes in, and maybe the team starts doing well or starts getting bad. Now, Coach Carter comes on the scene. One of the things we notice is that by the time he is able to get the discipline, those that are angry, you know, leave. People like Timo Cruz are angry and they say, no, man, I'm not going to deal with this nonsense. They leave and then he starts training them. The movie shows something where he uses, you know, stories. I like the way he uses analogies and, you know, stories. First of all, he uses the names of women. He says he talks about his aunt, Diane. And his sister, Diane. I think there are three ladies he did mention, Diane and Delilah.
She mentioned three ladies, but he had several sisters.
The issue here is the analogy to the game. What I mean is like he was using these names. Now, whether the stories are true or they are lies, you know, like his girlfriend that was sizzling hot like fire and all of that. And then he said, so he has a system where he calls names of a woman and then the team knows how to play. Now, I don't know what, I'm not really into how coaches actually do their job, because I have my own job. So the issue is that I don't know if that is a standard procedure or it's normal. But you see, he said, when we call Diane, we're going to play straight man-to-man pressure defense. When I call Delilah, we are playing trap defense. Yeah. And Linda was pick and roll. So basically, he has these codes. And as we see the game, when they played with St. Francis in the movie, you know, you see somebody calling a particular name, and then they will say, they just know how to organize themselves. And you think this played out very well with the outcome of their season?
One thing about young men is, if there's anything that can get young men interested, it's women. You know, when I was in secondary school, I had a friend of ours who was a good athlete, but he was the best athlete when there were women involved. Once there were some girls in our school that were, you know, around and watching what was going on, his performance levels rose to the highest. You know, when he was just among Oaks boys, you know, he could take it easy. But once he saw that there were people around, his performance levels rose. And so I've always had that in the back of my mind that sometimes what you can use to motivate young men is how you understand the dynamics with young women and what they're trying to do, you know, so because some of the things they do is basically just posturing, you know, they're just trying to attract a young girlfriend and do all those things. So some of the bravado and, you know, the slouching, the aggression, it's all about being the dominant or the alpha male. So in this system, he understood from beginning that, you know, he could get into their heads, you know, because it's not just about pure discipline. Pure discipline, they would have gotten tired and worked out. So he comes and says, you know, he likes women, he likes all this. And he knew this person, her name was Diane. And Diane was all in your face, man. She was aggressive, she was this. So, you know, they were going to run a play called Diane. Anytime I called Diane, I want you guys to be in everybody's face and aggressive. Yeah. So it was a good coaching technique. I think it was a very good coaching technique because it helped them build up muscle memory. Because sometimes what affects sports people is during the time of the play, when you have to solve a problem in a game and you have to create an instruction from scratch, it makes it harder for them to assimilate because their bodies are tired, they're a bit fatigued. So when you start telling them that, oh, I need you to do this, I need to do that, it's complicated. In the heat of the game, heat of the moment, with the crowd shouting either for you or against you, it's hard for you to get it done. But if I just say Diane, you know, or then instantly you have this memory of, oh, Diane is aggression. If I say Delilah, okay, we have to be fluid, we have to be tricky. You know, so he created a system of play that was conducive for the young men. And I thought it was very innovative.
What I think also is that this guy, I think Coach Carter used this technique as a means of, like, I agree, the muscle memory works very well so that we trigger, we know what we are doing immediately. You just say this thing. But at the end of the day, it might be the high point of, you know, using storytelling as a means to keep these boys engaged. If they will not come for practice, they may, you know, watch the story about Hattie May that Coach Carter told them during practice is something they could they could stay at home and talk about, or when they are hanging out together, say, oh man, that coach is crazy. He's a crazy guy. You know, he brought the drama into it as depicted in this movie, where he's able to do these things and people actually seem very interested. And I like the way the whole movie actually is paced, because they start going into their games. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They start winning. As is seen in this game, they start winning games and they are winning, and they become undefeated as it stands, because they are looking at people who are coming. They are coming from a season where they lost 22 games. Mm-hmm. And they start winning games. So it appears that Coach Carter was able to identify a lot of things. He said they didn't have any problem shooting the ball, like in basketball. You know, shooting versus dribbling now is a hot topic, because there's this whole discussion about, do we get people that can shoot ball very, very well, and you know, against people who can dribble? Because dribbling alone does not win games. It's somebody, if you can get the ball to somebody who can shoot. But he noticed that their problem was running. Hence the reason he was asking them to run suicides for a whole hour and everything. But let us take a break. And when we come back, we'll get into the real message of the movie.
When I first took the job at Richmond High School, they basically had no nets on the goal. They had no shoes. They had no socks. 50% of all the student athletes who entered Richmond High School never graduated. They was almost dead last academically in the state of California.
Okay, welcome back. And we've been talking about Coach Carter and how he's been able to take this team, as depicted in the movie, to, you know, an unbeaten streak. But you see, Coach Carter, this is not what the movie actually is about, as we all know. And he is looking at the streets of Richmond has a lot of history that seems to, you know, people are out there dealing drugs on the streets, people are getting killed. And the destruction of youth is depicted in this film as shown by one of the team members who has this girlfriend who is, you know, pregnant for him. And the pregnancy seems to be a threat to his life. And then there's this character called Timo Cruz. And Timo Cruz, actually, he's angry on the first day. He's not going to be down for signing all these kind of stupid contracts, and you are asking me to sign a contract for what? Meaning that I don't want to be disciplined. I want to do things my way. Mm-hmm. But then the movie shows where he goes out to the streets, and then he sees it, has a little taste of the streets, and then comes back to the basketball court and then goes out again. You know, we have this movement as shown in the whole broad concept of the film. But at the end of the day, it appears that apart from playing basketball, Timo Cruz, which is one of the main center characters here, is shown where he goes out into the street, and it appears that he's hanging out with wrong guys. Literally, they are selling drugs. I don't know what other thing they were doing out there. And Coach Carter is trying to keep them in school with these contracts, because it appears to be the thing that will actually get them out of trouble. One of the things I know is, like, I think it's a saying. It says, yeah, an idle mind is the devil's workshop. Or yes. So the thing is, exactly, like, that's exactly the same. So when you are properly engaged in something tangible, I don't know any other thing that can keep you out of trouble. Here, they tell you that if you're at work. You know all these politics they have at work. When you go to work and you are not doing your job, if you're doing the job you are supposed to be doing, 9 out of 10 times, you will not get into all this office trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happens, if they check you are where you were doing your job. So by trying to get these children engaged and giving them a 2.3 GPA to meet up to, which is not mm-hmm. so high in some people's cases, but to give them to try to get them playing basketball and give them a chance for the future.
You know, I believe that what he did was very key. Understanding that, like you said, the distractions of youth. Also understanding that these young boys, for some of them, the basketball they were playing in school was a means to an end. The means to an end in the sense that, you know, they see the NBA stars, they see the way they spend money, you know, maybe they watch MTV Cribs, you know, things like that. You know, they can see, they see the flashy cars, they see the fine ladies, when all you need to do is be physically good at something. You know, and for some of them, that was enough. But, you know, that character hadn't been built yet. They didn't have the right tools, you know, to get it right. So someone like Timo Cruz, who was a talented basketballer, but at the same time, he was also what you would call a gangbanger. You know, his cousin was a guy that was dealing drugs, and he was running things for him. You know, he'll deliver money to him, he'll sell something, deliver money to him. So he was doing it simultaneously. So when Coach Carter comes initially at the beginning of the movie with the whole you have to be disciplined thing, he sees it as an affront to what he stands for. For someone that, you know, gets stuff done, he doesn't need anybody telling him anything. He has it figured out already. You know, that's why he tries to punch Coach Carter, and he sees that he couldn't physically assault him. So he's like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
So he goes back to the streets, he's selling drugs, but he really loves the game of basketball. He had friends in the team that he really likes. And a lot of times in the movie, you see him looking at them from the outside, and, you know, he had this sort of desire to be back among the team. And, you know, it got to a point that when they started winning, he wanted a piece of that action. And in trying to get a piece of the action, he comes back to the team, and Coach Carter tells him that, you know, you can't make it into this team. Because Carter actually didn't even want him around because he felt it was a disruptive element.
I think so. He gives him discipline thing.
Yeah. So he gives him an impossible task. He tells him to do 1,000 suicides and 1,000 push-ups and 2,500 suicides. But what happened was at the end of the allotted time, Coach Carter was about to leave, and other team members, you know, stood up for him. Because not only is Cruz one of their friends, stand up for them on the streets. You know, there was a scene where some people were trying to bully three of the members, and Cruz comes with a gun and tells everybody to back off, that these are his people, they should back off. And so based on that, when he wanted to get back into the team and he wasn't enough, they decided to help him finish his tasks. Even Coach Carter's son, you know, they all did what he needed to do so they could get him back on the team. And, you know, it showed that the whole concept of being on the streets and all, it was something that a lot of them looked up to because they didn't have anything else. You know, either you do sports or you become a gangbanger, you know, you do drugs or you become a pimp or something, you know, very unsavory. But Coach Carter and all the things he did that so that he could get them to see that that was a dead-end situation. You know, it was a cul-de-sac. You get into it, there's only one way you're coming out. You know, he gave them stats of what happens to most of the African-American males in the neighborhood, of how many people from there go to college, of how many people who don't go to college make it in life. You know, he painted a picture of how it is in their homes, that how many of them are happy with their homes, and if there's a way for them to get out of the homes, the best way is through education. You know, he gave them those stats and left it for them.
I think one of the reasons why most of these things are put in this film, like those, some of those scenes, you know, when we see him coming, going and coming back, is so that at least within the concept of the whole story, we actually get to see some of the things, because it's not everybody that lives in the, I'm not living in Richmond. So what this movie tries to do basically is to show you some of the things that could happen as we see in some of these intermittent scenes. And I think it just uses the story of Timo Cruz to show you how he goes out and he comes back and the dangers of the streets, and a glimpse picture, and tries to show you exactly what Coach Carter is trying to do, what he's trying to save these children from. Because the key thing here is he's trying to save these children from something else. And for me, one other profound scene is when he starts having issues with the head of school, because she's like, oh, okay. He tries to talk to her. I think Richmond is supposed to be one on a ranking out of 10, meaning that they are really on a low, something within that neighborhood. Yeah. And they are having issues with money to pay faculty because they are not even getting the money they are supposed to be getting. The fact is, she's the first person that gives him the statistics that he gives to the boys, meaning that it's 50% of Richmond graduates. That's 50% of the students that graduate. Mm-hmm. And he says the higher percentage of them, they are girls. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you have 15 players on your team, you'll be lucky to graduate five of them. Five. That is the way she was putting it to him. And then you see the dialogue that ensues when he starts saying that, look, dude, your job is to win basketball games. I suggest you start doing your job. And then Coach Carter retorts. He says, your job is to educate these kids. I suggest you start doing yours. You see, primarily, there is this whole conflict here where the head of school just believes that there's a broken system, and this system does not allow these children to go to school and, you know, graduate and say, dude, you're just, you know, shut up and dribble, dude. Stay and be doing your job. Don't try to come into these broader issues. We know the problems. But you see, you're trying to get out of your lane. We are the educators. You are the basketball coach. And in all honesty, you're doing your job. One of the questions I ask is, what motivates a guy like Coach Carter to want to do these things for these kids? I look at the selflessness here because, dude, we are winning games. We're coming from a season of 22-4. You lost 22 games and we are undefeated. Means I'm doing my job. I can ask for a pay raise. I can get anything. They will give me whatever I want. Once a coach is winning games, they pretty much, you can ask whatever you will, they support you. But at the end of the day, what this guy is asking for is for children to settle down and study their books and pass exams, which I find to be rare because he is going to their classes. There's this particular character they call Junior Battle that the teacher said, When Coach Carter goes to the class to find out, because the teachers too, they were not giving him any information. It's as if he asked for feedback, they were not giving him. So one funny part was Junior Battle, when he goes and he says, look, these teachers, said Junior Battle is like an eclipse. We hardly see him, but when we see him, it's kind of special. These guys were not taking it seriously. Look, those kids were not taking it seriously, right?
The lady painted a picture. The skill you were trying to talk about was a scale of academic excellence. And out of a scale of 1 to 10, Richmond was a 1. 1 because most of the students weren't doing good. There was a 50% chance of people finishing high school. And out of that 50% chance of finishing high school, most of the people that haven't finished were ladies. Then beyond that, out of that 50%, 15% of them were the ones that even made it to college, if at all. So by the time they crunched all the numbers, when they look at the classrooms and look at the team, it showed that maybe one out of 15 might make it to college. Make it to college. Which means that most people will have dead-end jobs, you know, will forever be low income, will forever struggle, you know, will most likely not actualize what they would have true potential. You know, for some of these schools that are at the bottom of the ladder, the way the system works at the time is that you may end up lose funding. It's like funding goes to where there's excellence. The more they do well, the more funding goes to those places. So as the head of school, she was already struggling with dealing with lack of funding for a lot of things, a lot of programs to make the academics get better. So in the one area where there was some form of excellence, which was the basketball team, she was wondering why the basketball coach was trying to, you know, muscle into the other territory, basically, and get people to do things that they couldn't do before. And he had to explain to her that, look, that is the problem. The problem is not that we're winning basketball games or losing basketball. The problem is that these people aren't going to college. And that's what we need to solve, regardless of how good they are in basketball. That these people are student athletes, but they're students first. You know?
Yeah.
They're not athletes, they're students first. They're 16, 17-year-old kids that need to understand the value of an education and of honoring a contract.
I see it as a question of 16-year-old, 17-year-old, but my primary job here is to come and teach you how to play basketball, being your coach, and you're winning games. So my business now is I have done my job. I feel, you see, like I try to look at what is the big deal about this whole story. And, you know, why is it a story? Because big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have had big coaches come to a club and revamp things, but I think the big story for Coach Carter is the selflessness to start with, because he is looking beyond his primary job. Now, not to dwell too much on that, you see, but it appears that he is fighting a system that is already against him, because the teachers, they are looking at him. Look, shut up and do your job. You're winning games. You're doing fine. We love what you're doing with these boys. Don't try. If it's not broken, don't try to fix it. But look, here's the issue here now. But he is concerned about their lives because he's seeing them beyond playing basketball. They don't. I feel that this is the reason why this is a story. And you see, when they don't take him seriously, we now find a situation where he becomes, I don't know whether to call him an extremist because I don't know. You see, this is to me is the whole story, really, the bane of the whole thing, because I mean, he's trying to tell you that, look, I am not playing with this thing. Some people would have overlooked because they didn't take him seriously. You're signing contract. What are we signing contract about? But they didn't take him seriously. The boys, they didn't want to go to school and get their grades right. So when he finally gets a report that shows that they are not doing well, he goes to the extreme of locking their gym where they go to. They thought he was joking. And these are people who are undefeated. So, no practice, report to the library. And he has a meeting with their teachers and everything. He discusses with their teachers so that they are trying to communicate with him and let him understand that I'm not messing around. I'm not faffing around. You guys have to get your grades off. I've worked with your teachers if you need help and everything. So, he is seriously concerned about their grades beyond their winning games. And at the end of the day, he locks their gym. Now, you know, when he locks the gym for practice, it's not getting anybody's attention. When it starts getting the attention is when they have a game to play.
And nobody can play.
And the game is canceled. The gym is locked. That was when... Oh, they now said, look, I think that was a scene where I think the head of school comes to his office and Coach Carter says, that you finally know my office. I say, that's the first thing. Look, I have to go and look for this guy. What the heck is going on? People are calling me here and there. And, you know, people are calling me. What's wrong with this guy? She says, you finally know my office. You think I'm joking? They signed a contract. I feel like if Coach Carter had not signed a contract with these children, maybe
he couldn't have succeeded.
There would have been not be, and I think he
would have failed.
The whole thing was premeditated. I think he knew what he was doing, really.
Yes,
he knew
he had a vision.
He had a vision.
He had a vision. He envisaged problems that would come, pushback would come from the extra work, because what he was doing was basically giving everybody extra work. He was giving the boys extra work. They had to not just do well, not just score some points and dribble well. They had to read their books. He gave the parents extra work because the parents also signed the contract. He had to get the parents to sign the contract.
Yeah.
You know, and initially the parents signed the contract because their own was, if they sign the contract, the boys would get to play.
Yeah.
So that's why they signed the contract initially. Also, he gave the teachers extra work because the teachers had to ensure that the students' grades got better. And why he was able to succeed was a few teachers were able to volunteer some of the time and get it done. But if he hadn't, you know, visualized what would happen if he didn't do that, he would have had a pushback. Because towards the end, after he had that meeting with the principal and they missed the game, the local board had a meeting, a town hall meeting, where they brought his matter to the fore. And they were like, why is it that his job is to coach and the students are doing well on the team? Why would he cancel games and do all of those
things? They are undefeated. Yeah, undefeated, you know, the whole season.
They gave the floor to people to speak. One teacher complained that says that, you know, they like what he's doing with the team. He should just coach. That they are being given extra work just because the coach wants to get something. That these students are already, most of the students actually are doing even better than what he requires. But not all of them are doing it. So why should it be, why should everybody suffer because of some people? You know, some parents got up and complained. One mother got up and said that she's upset with all this. That why would they be telling them to do all the worms, mother? And she got up and was like, what she said was, Fremont game, the game that got canceled. Mm. She had scouts coming to the game. And you could tell where she was coming from. She was like, if scouts come and my son does well, this is a path to the future. You know, he gets to sign a big contract. You know, maybe he gets to skip college and go directly to the NBA, you know, to the professional leagues and, you know, endorsements and money and maybe better house, and he gets to move out of the hood. So everybody was being selfish about what they wanted. The teachers wanted less work. The parents wanted, you know, huge endorsements for their kids. You know, they just wanted their kids to excel and be on TV. Everybody wanted to do less. And Coach Carter stood up and I gave a rebuttal. He said, these kids are 16 to 17 year olds. They signed a contract. He emphasized that they signed a contract. And he told them, well, look, if we allow kids to break the contracts now, what happens when they become adults? What happens when they become professionals? You know, you can't continue like this. That if they do this thing, it won't be long before most of these kids end up in jail. And he reeled off some of the stats that the head of school had given him before. And he explained for the first time his true vision for what he wanted to do. And the principal saw it, and also the head of the town hall meeting. But when they took a vote, he still lost the votes. You know, the other board members were still members of the committee. He lost the votes. But he told everyone, look, if you guys don't allow me to complete what I wanted to do, you don't have to fire me. I will resign.
I'll resign, yeah. Yeah.
And he was about to resign, but the kids, some of the kids were there, and they saw the vision he had for them. And even though he offered to resign, they kept up the reigning. They said, look, they can open up everywhere, but we won't play till we fulfill what you wanted to fulfill. Because what he promised them when they signed the contract, that was, if they fulfill the contract, he will make them winners. And that's what they wanted more than any other thing.
For me, my definition of winners, according to Coach Carter, transcends the basketball game.
Basketball, yes.
Meaning that I'm talking about, you are going to be a winner, an all-encompassing winner. Now, one of the things I don't want us to glean over is, you see, I think some people saw what Coach Carter was trying to do by, you know, having a vote that some people voted no, some people voted yes, including the person who handled the meeting, I mean, the state board or so.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that, but we're having him drive on the street. His shop is being bashed in because people want to shout on him and say, let the boys play. So we're looking at the whole community. And these are the things, you see, these are the tales of greatness for me, because when you look at the whole situation and you're able to fight beyond it because you know that you are on the right side of history.
Yes.
Are on the right side. This is very, very hard for individuals who just want to live a life to maintain the status quo.
Yeah.
Because you for you to know that, look, what I am doing. But you see, it's as if he was the lone voice in the wilderness. The whole community could not see it. We're having people spitting on his car window on the road in traffic stop because they want their boy. They feel he is now the enemy. And it is amazing to me how all of a sudden these people feel that it was because of some kind of miraculous spiritualism or something that these boys came from a season where they were losing 22 games and they came into a season being undefeated. What were they thinking? Did they think that all of a sudden the boys just had a big S on their chest and they started winning games all of a sudden from nowhere? They all of a sudden saw Coach Carter as the enemy. And for me, these questions, the input, you know, this whole debate about coach versus players and who is more important, and all, that's a different topic altogether. But what I see in this story is that he was a lone voice in the wilderness. He knew what he was doing. And this is the reason why this thing now came to national attention, because the media got involved. You know, look, you see, in school, local school basketball in different countries, people don't really care. But games in a country like America is something they watch on TV. They follow it even to high school level. They are following the market and everything. So you're having people like this woman that you cited, that she's only thinking about her son is going to get, the scouts are coming to watch her son. The teacher on the other end is complaining that you guys are giving me more work to do. And you see, these are the things that make it a story, because I just feel like, look, he could have just said, man, F you guys, I'm just doing my, maybe I should just settle down and do my job. And a lot of people have slipped into this particular thing where they felt they were trying to do good, but they look around themselves. One of the most discouraging things you can ever think of is you're trying to do a good thing. You know you're trying to do a good thing, but you're getting a backlash from a whole community, a whole community. That is a situation that you really don't know how it feels like unless you are in it. Let's go for a break.
So what did you hear, Mr. Carter, that made you bench the team? Did you get some information from the teachers that they weren't holding up their end of the bargain?
Yes, ma'am. Every Monday, I have teachers put responses in my box about how our student athletes are acting and whether their participation in class is good and how they're acting as just young men.
And you heard that some of them were not acting correctly, right?
Yes, ma'am. And so when I got that report back, I had to do something, because we have some excellent young men here at our school, and it's a shame if they don't get a chance to play or to go to college.
We have been talking about Coach Carter, the movie, and we're trying to make sense and what motivates Coach, what actually motivated Coach Carter to do all the things he did for the students that he coached during his time as a basketball coach with Richmond, as depicted in this movie, Coach Carter. Now, one significant thing we notice is, I think it was only Timo Cruz he addressed with that thing when he would ask this question, what is your greatest fear? And, you know, what is your greatest fear? As we see in the movie, when the community is against him, but he still stands his ground. They vote to open the gym, and he says, if you guys vote, I quit. Because we're trying to teach these children something wrong. But as the movie plays out, it appears the children now learn. And they feel like, look, this thing this guy is trying to do, I am going to be a primary beneficiary. Because he gives them the statistics when he gives them, you know, what I call the stats for your ass. And that's in the typical Samuel Jackson voice. And you have, you know, I want to, first of all, like, read the quote from Samuel Jackson, what he actually told his kids, which I believe is the elixir that actually changed their mind and their thinking to wake up. And he said, I see a system that's designed for you to fail. I know you all like stats, so let me give you some stats. I like Samuel Jackson's voice. I'll just have to tell you that for sure.
It's part of his charm.
Yeah, so Richmond High only graduates 50% of its students. And of those that do graduate, only 6% go to college. Which tells me that when I walk down these halls and I look into your classrooms, maybe only one student is going to go to college because people don't go to class. And you may ask, if I don't go to college, where am I going to go? The answer is probably prison. In this country, 33% of black males between 18 and 24 get arrested. So look at the guy on your left. Now look at the guy on your right. One of you is going to get arrested. Growing up here in Richmond, you're 80% more likely to go to prison than college. Those are the numbers. Those are some stats for your ass.
How about you call it mic drop?
If you did not wake up after hearing that, I don't know what you need is you need deliverance. Because I don't know what other way to. You need extra help for lack of any other way to put it. So that changed their life. And we see over the movie when he's trying, because I notice he has particular interest in Timo Cruz, which I don't know whether it's something that the film tries to highlight. So when we notice he keeps asking these questions, and then at the end of the day, towards the end of the film, we find that Timo Cruz actually has done his research by himself, and he answers you. Can you read the quote out for?
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. It's not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
Yes, that was basically the greatest fear as depicted in this film. And for all I can find, the I think that is attributed to somebody called Miriam Williamson. That's the greatest I have seen that. So, and that is the crux of this whole movie, is just showing that that Coach Carter actually saw beyond. He turned athletes into students instead of students into athletes, which was a national story at the end of the day. In all honesty, you see that contract, the only part of that contract me I was against was sitting in the front row seats.
I was sitting in the front row seats.
It's enough. I want to get my grades. You want me now to sit in the front row? I'm just trying to measure what aspect of discipline you're trying to instill in me. Are you trying to get me to pay attention? I shouldn't be on my phone or what?
It's an attention thing. I'm sure there's a stat somewhere that shows the amount, the correlation between sitting in front and getting high grades. That happens at the back is there are a lot of distractions at the back, a lot of side talk, a lot of gossiping. And if you sit in front, you have nowhere to look except the teacher or the blackboard. You know, you can't start talking if you're in front of the class unless you're truly beyond saving.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I guess that was the only part I just found a little bit like I felt away. But I think based on what you just said now, it makes sense, because at the front row, you're just looking exactly at the teacher's face and, dude, you better not. If you blink, he'll catch you. But at the back, the whole war is going on at the back. In all, I think it was a great film, and I think it was worth talking about, because the movie that he did something rare. I believe that if we had more educators that cared about the seeing beyond college, because if we are just looking at the system and the main issue we are thinking about is funding for the school, what do we need to do for funding? But if people who come to the school get the primary thing they were looking for, like at least graduate, go to college. The academics is one thing that if you're engrossed in it, you pretty much will not have time for a lot of things. And it will keep you out of trouble, because there's no way you can be selling drugs and be reading and getting a 3 points GPA.
Yeah.
There's no way. So it's kind of entices you in, which I find quite fascinating.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. You can follow our podcast on Facebook at Remote Talkatives, and that's Talkatives with an ER, or you can follow on Twitter at rtalkatives, and that's also talkatives with an ER. Now, we post movies that we're going to talk about before we actually publish them on Spotify and any place you listen to your podcast. You can also send us an email at podcast@remotetalkatives.com. You can send us feedback, tell us what you think, suggest a movie, or just basically comment on some of the things that you feel should have happened based on what we have talked about. We welcome feedback, and we thank you once again for listening, and we will see you next week with another discussion.